they showcased it at this big tournament, and the bot beat every single pro player handedly, just destroyed them. It showed them some strategies that they had never thought of before, but this AI had come to learn.
This is Brain Inspired.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Paul Middlebrooks. Today, my guest is Dr. Blake Porter. He's a neuroscientist doing postdoctoral work in Kristen Hillman's lab at the University of Otago in New Zealand. I'm going to tell you right off the bat here, I'm breaking the rules of the show already, in that Blake is purely on the neuroscience side of the fence for now. He studies how the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex are involved with effortful behavior and self-control during decision-making. And we talk about one of his studies recording place cell neurons in rats while they run up and down hills. Exhausting. This was fun for me because Blake is an electrophysiologist like me, or at least like I used to be. So we know each other's pain well. Enjoy. But if you're more interested in the AI side of things, don't worry, we talk about AI. Blake dabbles in the gaming world, and he told me about the AI bots that companies like OpenAI and DeepMind are working on and making to take over the world of professional gaming. We talk about the status of the AI bots' skills so far. But since we talked, those skills have improved. So in the show notes, I link to a video showing the bots developed by OpenAI dominating in a team game. And since then, Bill Gates has suggested that this is a landmark in progress in AI. So there you go. We cover plenty more as well, and you can find the show notes all at braininspired.co. Enjoy. All right, I've got Dr. Blake Porter with me today, all the way from New Zealand. He's a postdoc at the University of Otago. People might be able to hear, you're not native. You don't sound native.
No, I'm not. I grew up in South Florida, and then I did my undergraduate degree at Boston University in neuroscience, and then worked there for a little while longer, and then came over here to do my PhD.
So how did the decision to do your PhD in New Zealand come about?
It was a few different reasons. I had graduated BU. I was looking for more research assistant jobs around Boston. Really wasn't having any luck. I had quite a few interviews through actually the website Reddit. I had saw someone was posting about their research, and they ended up being at the University of Otago down here in New Zealand. So I just checked it out and happened to see that there was a job posting for a research assistant in a lab here. And it was exactly what my honors project was on, looking at the interaction between the hippocampus and medial prefrontal cortex. So it was almost too perfect of a fit.
Yeah.
So I applied for that as a research assistant and went through. We had a few Skype interviews, and it was almost a done deal, but it turned out getting a work visa for what would really be considered a lower or mid-tier job as a research assistant would be pretty difficult. So instead, he offered me a PhD position instead. I went with that, and that was sort of, it all happened pretty quick and kind of out of nowhere. It wasn't really planned. I did have plans to get a PhD eventually, but for anyone out there listening, I didn't have the greatest GPA and thought I wouldn't really have any chance to get into a PhD program.
Blake, I can almost guarantee that I had a lower GPA than you did.
Really?
Yo, man, I hold the record for lowest GPA ever entered into the program.
Wow. Okay, maybe you do have me beat then.
It's kind of a long story, but yeah. that is what a fortuitous occurrence in your life there.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy, and it all happened very quickly.
Wow. Were you worried about the transition to New Zealand?
Not so much. I had already sort of made a big transition of going from Florida to Boston for my undergrad, so I had done that before, but New Zealand is very, very far. So that's probably the only downside, really. But I really like it here. The weather's great. The people are so friendly. I really had no problems coming over here.
I've never heard a bad thing about New Zealand. But so you went from crocodile legs, you know, delicacy to the clam chowder. I'm not going to do my Boston accent. To what is the, now what are you eating regularly in New Zealand that I don't get here?
Their big thing is sheep and lamb. So I would say that's probably one of the bigger dishes here. But they also just have more of their comfort food. There's something called cheese rolls. And it's not as elaborate as you might think. It's just white bread and cheese rolled together and fried. It's similar to our grilled cheese, but it's a cheese roll.
Yeah.
So that's sort of a cultural staple in New Zealand.
Yeah, they really aren't far from us then. So
no.
So do you mind filling in the listeners on how you and I came to be speaking right now?
Sure. I had a little, where should I start with this?
Well, I contacted you.
Yeah, yeah. So you contacted me because I have my website, which is blakeporterneuro.com. And also linked to that is a SoundCloud, which has a bunch of recordings that I did of the sounds of neurons.
So I had spent about a month, this is embarrassing, but I had spent about a month trying to figure out what I was going to use as the introduction to this little podcast. And I had even written a jingle and played it on my guitar. And I sent it to a few friends and they're like, it's catchy, but doesn't sound great, you know? So then I came up with the idea that I could incorporate some neuron sounds. That then I started Googling, and yours was the top.
Nice. Good to know.
Then I reached out and said, oh, please, can I use your recordings for the intro to my show? And you were really gracious in letting me do that. So thank you. Very official thank you.
Of course. I think something seemed to have happened. I guess Google changed their algorithm or something, and that SoundCloud and also the webpage that has them has gotten so much more traffic. I'm not sure what happened. I didn't do anything.
Interesting. Well, I've had a couple people tell me that they think the cackling might annoy some listeners, but I'm like, really? They're real neurons,
such a beautiful
though.
Beautiful sound.
I know. Do you want to tell people what the sound is?
Yeah, this was all the work I've done in general was in rats, although I have started to work in pigeons, but this is all rats. And most of all of these recordings, they were just running back and forth on a track. I think there is a few recordings on there of rats while they're sleeping.
I saw those, but I needed them to pop a little faster, so I didn't use the sleeping ones. So how did you get into neuroscience? How did you know that that's what you wanted to do?
When I was probably, I was much younger, I think second or third grade. So my family is from New England, from actually the island of Nantucket. And there, I actually got bit by a tick and got Lyme disease.
Oh, my gosh.
Sort of a New England thing, but briefly, it's a tick-borne illness. And it's a pretty crazy bacteria that the ticks will infect you with. So it took a while to get diagnosed, and then I had a pretty substantial antibiotic treatment. It was 30 days hooked up to an IV. This bacteria attacks almost your whole body, but specifically your heart, your joints, and your nervous system, including your brain. So I had these residual headaches for a very long time, and there was some real metrics to go with them. I had quite increased cerebral spinal fluid pressure. They thought I had a tumor. It did not, after a bunch of brain scans. So I just kind of had a long childhood of head-related things that sort of, as I got older, got me more and more curious in the brain.
My wife is from, she has family in the New England area, and we vacation in Old Lyme every year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we do regular tick checks around here. Even right now, we're in Colorado, but we still do them here. Haven't done one in a while. I should remind her. We're due for a tick check on the kids. So let's talk a little bit about some of the work you did about hippocampal place cell encoding of sloping terrain. So this is all about the famous place cells. In this experiment, you basically took rats and gave them a little roller coaster and recorded their neurons. Maybe you can be a little more specific. And maybe we just, could you explain before you talk about the experiment a little bit, what are place cells?
Sure. Place cells generally are these pretty specialized neurons found in the hippocampus of all mammals that we've so far looked at. There's evidence for them in humans, as well as rats and mice and bats. And they're these specialized cells that, as the name implies, they fire or they're active in a specific place within an environment. So as you are sitting at your computer, you have place cells firing away that tell you tells your brain, okay, you're at your computer. There's more play cells for your kitchen and for your living room. So these cells are thought to give you sort of a map, a cognitive map of the world. You can imagine if you start to link together dozens and the hundreds of thousands of play cells that you have, you can get a complete map of the environment.
And they're really well studied at this point, but what I learned from reading your paper is that the vast majority of research done with these play cells has been on very even terrain, so not ecologically normal terrain. There have been no hurdles that rats have had to jump over, etc. So how is this research different?
There was some interest, I think 2001 and 2000, where they started to look at play cells in 3D environments. And then there was one paper in 2001 that looked at play cells in a tilted maze. And it kind of went dormant for a while until a researcher at University College London, Kate Jeffrey, started to really look into how are these cells responding to 3D space. Because, as you said, most experiments are just in a flat environment that doesn't have a whole lot to do with how our real world is shaped and how rats or animals in general would be navigating the world. So briefly, the grant funding my PhD was for the neuromechanisms of self-control. What I focused on was, in self-control, you usually give up something that's easy or avoid some easy choice for a more difficult choice. And the decision-making part of this has been studied quite well, but I was interested in how is the information of difficulty or ease getting to our decision-making parts of the brain. So we thought to look, instead of in decision-making cortices like the prefrontal cortex, but instead to look back in regions that feed into the medial prefrontal cortex, like the hippocampus, and see how the hippocampus was responding to difficult environments and difficult situations, and how the information would then be relayed to other decision-making cortices.
And what was it that you found? What were the results in the paper?
I'll start with, it's been well known previously that when you start to make manipulations to an environment, that play cells will respond to those manipulations. So for example, if you put a rat in a blue box, play cells will fire and play cells will map out that blue box. Then if you, in the same location, in the same everything, but you put the rats in a red box, you'll get all new play cells that map this new environment. Even though there's a lot of features are similar, you'll start to get different representations for small changes. And you can even make very small changes where, say, you have your environment, but you have a cue card, so like a white square on the wall, and you can rotate that white square, say 90 degrees, to the other wall, and some play cells will respond to that. So this is a concept called remapping. So to set up the experiment, I ran rats on a shuttle box. So it was a little over a yard long. Rats run back and forth, and they get two Cocoa Puffs at each end, which rats love. And as they were running, I would change the tilt of the track. So it could lie flat on the ground at 0 degrees, but it could also increase to 15 degrees or 25 degrees. So 25 degrees was pretty steep. I actually didn't go any higher than that because the rats started to just slide down, which was much more efficient than trying to walk down. So if anyone's wondering why it went to 25 degrees and not 30. So we found that as the environment was changed, as it was made more difficult, as the slope increased, we saw partial complex remapping, where some play cells were stable across different slope angles, but other play cells changed their activity and remapped. Most of the time, play cells would just shut off or turn on. So if I went from 0 degrees to 15 degrees, you'd have about half of the play cells would either turn on or would get a bunch of new play cells turning on and some turning off. So these results go on to show that when you have change the tilt of the maze and you get this partial remapping of play cells, that some play cells are remaining stable, and this might help link together the representation of this environment, since the environment is more or less the same, whereas the play cells that remap, these play cells that change, are the ones conveying information about the tilt of the environment.
That's what I was going to ask, if it had to do with remapping as if learning a new environment and remembering that there's a mountain there that I have to run over, or if it has to do with the actual effort that it takes.
This gets a little more nuanced into remapping literature. These rats, for my experiment, were extremely well-trained on this task, so that they had already seen 15 and 25 degrees dozens and dozens of times, so it wasn't anything new to them. If it had been new, we might expect a lot more remapping to going on during learning, but these were likely already stable representations that the hippocampus was switching between as the tilt was changed.
That's a cool study, and such a subtle manipulation that, there's just so much science to be done. And you think, play cells, well, we know all about them. But then it just takes a subtle manipulation, and then, there's a new results.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on the paper. I know that it takes quite a bit of effort to record electrophysiology. and in fact, on your blog, so you keep a blog on blakeporterneuro.com, one of the stories I enjoyed, because I recorded electrophysiology, and so I'm familiar with the effort it takes, and you detailed the, shall we call it the tour de force? No, that's the wrong phrase, but the trials and tribulations of trying to figure out where some noise was coming in your recordings. Do you want to just tell me about that real quick?
Sure. Our equipment is extremely sensitive, so we're always picking up all sorts of noise. And for this particular instance, so I have many more stories of electrical noise, as everyone does, I was almost finished up with data collection. I just had a few days left to finish up an experiment. And then we started to just get this very, very weird noise coming in. We had a power surge in the building. We have an older building, and it's kind of cobbled together with a brand new building, so sometimes we have some power issues. And we had these power surges, and then things started to get really weird that night. And I had tried all the things. I swapped out every piece of hardware I possibly could, tried different rats. This noise was there all the time. I had electrical technicians come out, electrical engineers come out. Everyone was pretty stumped. We thought we fixed it one day, and then it came back a few hours later, and then it started to at least get more regular. Seemed to be occurring around 4:30, 5 o'clock. And I should preface this, in New Zealand, we're in the winter now. So it was already getting dark at 4:35.
Right.
So over time, this noise looked kind of familiar. It was just very massive fluctuations in the signals, which you would never see in a real brain, or you'd hope to never see in a real brain. And it finally clicked that I'd seen this noise before when you turn on our fluorescent bulbs. So fluorescent bulbs need a massive amount of voltage to get started, in the hundreds of thousands of volts to get going, and it just causes a ton of noise in our system, but it's only when they're turning on. But it also happens when they're flickering and they're dying and they're trying to turn on, but they can't. So this was a clue, but I couldn't find any broken bulbs or flickering bulbs. I checked all my floor. I checked on all the floors below me, and there's no floors above me. And eventually, after a whole week, I went outside and found that there was a big fluorescent bulb outside of our building that was flickering. And I quickly got our technicians to take it out at the very end of the day. This is almost already 5 o'clock, but thankfully they're great guys and did take it out, and the noise was gone.
Da, da, so, da.
It was all to one flickering bulb outside. Oh, so what a week.
And that is neurophysiology, folks. I really like reading that story. I mean, it's like I'm smiling, but also have a single tear coming down my cheek, you know? Just so much wasted time, so much time spent where you're really not learning anything during those time periods. You're learning very little relative to how painful it is. So
it's full days of troubleshooting and just trying to swap out each piece of equipment, because there's so many pieces of equipment, trying different rats. And just a quick side note, in my PhD, the room that I was working in was actually numbered 404, which is the web error if you can't find the web page. And that room was equally as cursed as this whole week was, of just constantly dealing with noise in that room. And I left after about 2 years into my PhD. I just gave up on room 404 and went over to 405, and everything was fine.
Everything was better. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you telling us the story. So I know that you can't talk too much about what you're doing now, but can you give us just a brief overview? And you're still working in the effort-based realm, right?
Yeah. One of my PhD advisors, Kristen Hillman, and my PhD followed up with her work, which was effort, really effort decision-making in the prefrontal cortices, the ACC in particular. We applied for a Marsden grant, which is kind of like the NSF of New Zealand. They fund all sorts of basic research in all fields. And we received that, and that is for the neural mechanisms of quitting, persistence and quitting. So from the work of Kristen and David, their ideas were that the ACC was sort of providing the rest of the brain with a persistent signal. The ACC has a lot to do with effort and evaluating effort and figuring out, is this effort worth pursuing, or should I take the easier path, or should I do something else?
But now, do you mean persistence in quitting as in staying quit?
It can be more transient, of just quitting one specific behavior at one time.
I see.
So not so much chronic quitting at this point, but maybe down the line.
Mm-hmm.
So this work is not only based in like rodent electrophysiology, but also in some human work, actually, where they were doing brain surgery on humans and doing cingulotomies, where they're taking out the ACC.
Hmm.
But beforehand, they would stimulate the ACC, and people during brain surgery are generally awake because there's no pain fibers in your brain. And they would stimulate the ACC, and people would just feel this massive drive and motivation, and just that the self-reports are like, I feel like I can do anything and accomplish anything. So that, coupled with all the rodent electrophysiology, seemed to be that the ACC is giving the brain some signal to persist at something, even if it's difficult. So in rats, if you lesion the ACC, they won't like to expend effort. They get very lazy. They're adverse to expending any effort. And I'm sure everyone's familiar with that feeling of not wanting to go to the gym or expend the mental effort of eating healthy or something like that. So
I happen to be in the beautiful state of Colorado right now, and I was wondering about THC studies and binding of THC receptors in ACC and whether that affects people's efforts.
I want to say that rings a bell. I'm pretty sure there's a few papers on THC and cannabinoids. I know there's one. I can't remember the details now, but
sounds like I'll be needing to do some experimentation while I'm here, and I'll get back to you on that.
Sounds good.
Well, man, so I know you've finished collecting the data, we were just talking earlier before the show about now your life is MATLAB and how that's a little bit different, a little bit easier in some respects, but also intense. And now you're in the coding and analysis world. So good luck with that.
Thanks. Yeah, we got a bunch of great pilot data over the past 6 months or so. So start to analyze it.
And then you'll probably write about it once you, do you wait to write about these things on your website? Once you get it published, you write about it?
Yeah, more or less. Though I have been looking more and more into like preprints. But for now, I've been waiting till it's published.
I want to congratulate you and just, I really admire that you write about it. I think it's so important. You're welcome. I think it's so important for scientists to communicate their work, and so many of us are so poor at it. So it's really enjoyable when someone is so good at it. So I just really appreciate that. So keep up the good work.
Thanks, Paul.
So this is a podcast about artificial intelligence and neuroscience and the interface. Mm-hmm. And we've been talking neuroscience, and you're a neuroscientist, but I know that you have interest in AI. So all of the analyses that you do, presumably, are pretty tried and true neuroscientific approaches. Do you have a vision for how you might incorporate things that are either learned from AI or incorporate tools from AI in the future?
Yeah, at present, I do just go with quote-unquote conventional analyses and haven't, in my academic work, done anything with neural networks or artificial intelligence. there does seem to be, as these AI tools are more and more accessible and more people write great libraries that is much higher level code, so you don't have to do all the nitty-gritty coding, that there's quite a few papers coming out now more and more where they'll find something that goes on in the brain with electrophysiology, and then they'll model it in AI and see if an AI agent behaves the same with the same sort of parameter setup. So that's been pretty interesting. That's been going on for a while, where you find something in the brain and then you model it. But it seems more and more like neural networks are now being used rather than more conventional AI models.
Yeah. So just if you had to guess, which discipline would benefit more from the other? Do you think that neuroscientists will benefit from the AI machine learning world more so in the tools that can be wrought, or do you think that neuroscience can inform AI researchers and push it forward at a faster clip?
I'm probably biased, but I think AI could learn more from neuroscience. I think it'd be really interesting to see more concepts and neural functions that we know go on in a real brain, of adapting those into AI. This might be for a little later if you want to go back to this, but for the AI that's being worked on for video games, such as StarCraft and Dota, I know they are starting to use some concepts from neuroscience and specifically from the hippocampus, which is where those place cells are. But the hippocampus has another role in that it's required to form memories. So if you don't have a hippocampus, you literally can't form memories. And there's a functionality of the hippocampus called replay, where previous experiences are replayed more or less spontaneously. And it's thought that these replay events really help us to consolidate memories, perhaps used in decision making. So you'll replay your past experiences and say, okay, this isn't conscious necessarily, but replaying past experiences to inform your current decision making. And I just learned that DeepMind, they actually have applied this replay function to their AI, where it will store all of its past experiences, and then at every I guess you call decision point, at every state, it will randomly sample from these quote unquote memories and replay them and use them to inform decision making. And they had said that adding this replay functionality really improved the learning rate of their AI. So I think it'd be pretty cool to see more neuroscience and brain functionality try to be incorporated into AI.
That's a really good example, and I'll have to look that up, because I'm wanting to eventually interview someone from DeepMind. I've been looking into them a little bit. You mentioned this Dota, and I say it because and you also mentioned I had asked you, hey, could you before the podcast started, I asked you, could you wear some headphones? Because I think the audio will be better. And you're like, yeah, it's cool. I got it. I got a gaming headset here. It's going to be good. You know, all I do is sit around and watch Crocodile Dundee reruns. So I'm not a gamer. So what are you talking about? You had mentioned Dota 2 to me before. And So this is a game and you play it. And how does it relate to AI?
Sure. To briefly go over Dota and to set up the AI, Dota was a mod for a game called Warcraft 3, which came out quite a long time ago, about 2003, a long time ago for me. And me and my friends played Dota 1. So Dota stands for Defense of the Ancients. Huh. And the overall concept of the game is really simple. It's five people versus five other people. It's on a rectangular map. One team has a base in one corner. The other team's base is in the diagonal corner. And you are trying to take your enemy's base while your enemy tries to take your base. Within your base, there is, from the game lore, an ancient, just sort of a god statue. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to kill your opponent's ancient while defending your ancient. So Defense of the Ancients, that's where the Dota comes from. And so Dota 2's been this huge online game, esport, if you will, where the tournament prizes are upwards of the millions and millions of dollars now, over tens of millions of dollars. And as I said, at the top level, the game's pretty simple. You're just fighting another team. But those five players, you have about 115 different heroes to choose from. So these are heroes with different abilities and different skills. Each hero has about four abilities, but some have many more. On top of that, you have about 100 or so items that you can purchase to make your character even better. So the game gets extremely complex very quickly, and it's one of those games where even just to learn it, it takes a while, but to master it, many people have said it takes thousands of hours. I'll admit, I just checked before the interview. I've played 2,400 hours so far of Dota 2 alone.
We can bleep that out later if we need to.
I'm nowhere near a pro level. There's many pro players who that is just their full-time job, where they practice and play for 8 to 12, 16 hours a day. They're sponsored. They get a salary on top of their tournament winnings. So since the game was so complex, it seemed like a really interesting AI problem and for a bot to come up with a bot that could play this game. So OpenAI, the frontman of Elon Musk, came up with this bot for Dota, and they had it at the last tournament. So they trained this bot extremely quickly, too. They claim it only took 6 months to train it from nothing to the level it was at. And they showcased it at this big tournament, and the bot beat every single pro player handedly, just destroyed them.
You say 6 months, but that actually sounds like a long time in machine learning training time. Is that 6 months from turning it on, because machines can run around the clock? And
I'm not sure if that was total development or if that was just training time. If it was just training time, yeah, you're right. That's a lot. It's very black box at the moment. They haven't really released details of what tools, what AI they're using, but they said they're running multiple versions of the bot all the time. And the bot just, like I said, beat every pro player easily. And it showed them some strategies that they had never thought of before, but this AI had come to learn. And once the pro player saw it, they were just like, why did we not think of this over the past 15 years?
Yeah, so this is another example, another complex example of a learning algorithm eventually beating the best in the world, which has been done in chess, and AlphaGo has done it, and I'm sure others are on the rise. But now I'm going to have to go visit, procure some THC, come back, get on some Dota 2, and play against a bot and see how I do. I'm sure I'll fare so well.
There's one more thing. So OpenAI is trying to tackle Dota, but Google's DeepMind is trying to tackle StarCraft, which is probably an even more complex strategy game. And DeepMind has just released, kind of at the same time, a huge library and package of resources that you can not only use their AI, but you can very easily interface with the StarCraft game. And they've set up a whole suite where if you want to get into gaming but don't want to be the actual gamer, you can go design your own bots to play. They've released a bunch of sort of training grounds or playgrounds to build up your bot skill. But they sort of admitted in their paper that their bot, despite being able to do all the basics, was never able to beat a human in StarCraft yet. So,
I mean, that's just a matter of time, right? The gaming approach, the beat humans in a game, is almost... to say this is somewhat insulting, because it takes a lot of work to do this, but it's almost a foregone conclusion now to me that games are done for humans, you know, with expertise. But so what about you? Do you have any crazy ideas about what might be, you know, about the brain or the future of neuroscience or learning about the mind or artificial intelligence that someone might say sounds a little crazy?
I'm sort of side interested as well, another side interest of using sort of non-invasive brain recording techniques, somewhere like EEG. And these are starting to come out and be more commercially accessible. I know there's quite a few toys now where you can, say, control a drone with your brain,
right,
or meditation EEG caps. And I think as the costs are coming down, as technology gets better and better and these EEG caps become more accessible and maybe more home use easy to see what we do with that. So I think that'll be quite interesting on the neuroscience front to see, try to record brain activity. I know a lot of companies are working on it. I think Microsoft and Facebook both have brain research branches of more seamlessly integrating your brain and your thoughts with a computer instead of having to use a mouse and keyboard. That's what I'm most interested in.
So if you had to guess, how long will it be before we are, just to give a concrete example, thinking instead of saying voice activated, saying or typing in, you just have to think Skype, call Blake Porter, and it does it for you.
I think in a research lab with research lab level equipment, you could probably do it at this stage. But to get it cost effective enough and develop really the AI to learn, I think the biggest problem from my understanding from the sense of EEG, which is just that's when you see the pictures of people with a brain cap on and it's just measuring the activity that's already passed through your skull and through your skin. So the brain activity is kind of distorted and you need to spend a lot of time training something in AI or neural network on, okay, this brain activity means make a Skype call. And that just takes a lot of training and a lot of learning. I can't imagine it being too far off. When it gets commercially viable, that might be a different question that I'm not sure about.
Over under 10 years.
Under.
Under. Okay. I agree with you.
Yeah.
Well, for people who might be thinking about going into neuroscience and or maybe an undergrad right now and thinking about going into graduate school, if you don't mind answering, what's something that you wish you knew going into neuroscience research that you didn't know before going in?
I'll give you two things for this one, and I'm sure one you'll agree with. I really didn't know what went on to be an academic and what academia was going to be like and just how much work it takes to go from a bachelor's degree to if you want to go in to be a professor, or even if you get a bachelor's or maybe a master's and then stay as sort of a research assistant or a technician level, just how much of a roller coaster it is to find and keep jobs in science. So people who don't know, pretty much all research jobs are based off grants. These grants have a finite time period, 2, 3, maybe 5 years if it's a big grant. So you never sort of have much stability. There's definitely some labs who have that, but I'd say the majority of the time you're only ever employed for a fixed term of 2 to 3 years, and then you need to find another job again. So that's something to keep in mind that I did not know until later on. And then the other thing would be, I'd encourage anyone going into neuroscience or really any science in general is to try to learn programming. It's been such a vital skill for me that I picked up. I took a pretty big chunk of my PhD to just learn a programming language called MATLAB.
I did too. I learned it during my PhD program. And most people, you know, a lot of people coming in these days get some of that experience in undergrad, but I actually learned Fortran in undergrad, which, so I had some programming experience. Ooh. but yeah, I think that's really good advice.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's something that you wish was on your CV that's not on there yet?
Probably just some more publication.
Okay, that's an easy answer. That's good. I like that.
That's another thing going back to your other question of just academia has turned into publish or perish. So you just have to publish as many papers as you can, which is hard.
It is hard. I mean, talking about the coding again, in my experience, it's hard to say for sure because I never timed it, but the majority of my time was spent coding and doing the, writing the code for the analysis. Because once you get the code working, you just press go and it only takes so long. So there's a lot of time recording the data and gathering the data, but there's even more time writing the code, especially if you have a somewhat complicated task or more, you know, more than three conditions, et cetera. So,
yeah. In my, briefly, in my pigeon work, the pigeons are more or less in operand boxes and following these different programs. So things like, we just had a paper out on temporal discounting. So do pigeons understand, or do pigeons have the concept that immediate rewards are more valuable than later rewards? But the things that the pigeons just come up with that you never think of has never ceased to surprise me and makes coding the analysis much more difficult because you have to take into account all these little tricks that the pigeons eventually come up to learn and just totally screw with what you thought they would do versus what they actually do, and then handling all those exceptions that the birds come up with.
Huh, that's interesting.
And rats do too. But
yeah, well, those are all freely behaving animals as well, pretty much. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're fine. I mean, my favorite as a postdoc, my task was a little more complex. There's a lot of conditions, and you know, my advisor would ask me, "Okay, can you just look into this one particular thing?" And it would sink me because it sounds so easy, and it's like, "Oh my god, that's like a week worth of coding right there," you know. And he didn't know that. There's no way he could know that. Yeah, easy. I know. I say a week, and that's being optimistic. Blake, this is fun because we just had our 1 year anniversary of me quitting academia and moving into this RV to live and travel with my family. So you know, you're bringing up all these feelings now about my academic work. Thank you, Blake, for your time. I mean, I've taken up a lot of it. Thank you for the research you're doing and the education that you're doing, taking the time to think about and write about what you do. I know if that was me, that would take me hours.
I have to admit, I don't know if my supervisor will hear this, but it's really just a procrastination tool to not have to write manuscripts.
Well, but you know, it's a great one because it helps frame how to write them. So it's such a great exercise. And it just allows, I suppose I could say layman, but even, well, let's just stick with layman, to really get a better understanding of what you're doing. So if people want to check that out, would you want them to go check out your blog?
Yeah, blakeporterneuro.com would be probably the best place to go.
You know, so what I'm going to do at the very end of this, I'm going to fade out with a different file of neurons. Did you have a particular neuron of a rat doing a particular thing that you'd like to send out the listener in this episode?
I don't know. I think it'd probably be good to, if you have one of the hippocampus and another one of ACC recordings, it would be interesting.
So I'll put them back to back and compare them. Well, thanks again, man. I appreciate the time and keep up the good work.
Sure. Thanks so much, Paul.
Okay. I hope you enjoyed my chat with Blake Porter. As I was instructed, I leave you today with sounds of rat neurons recorded by Blake, the same types of neurons that I use to open the show. Sounds like home. All right. Here's a few seconds of an anterior cingulate cortex neuron, a little bit on the quiet side. And I'll close it out with a bang. Here's a few seconds of a bursty interneuron recorded from the rat hippocampus. See you next time.